It's time for the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On today's show, Taylor Charlson will have a report about a revived ancient grafting technique that is bolstering the California watermelon industry. And Kylie Harlan will be in with a feature report providing information on Ag Groups' pleas to federal officials for quick availability on water project funding. And I'll have a look at regional and national agricultural news, beginning with regional Ag News right after this.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns on September 28th and 29th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this two-day conference features two concurrent CE tracks for both PCAs and CCAs. Earn the DPR and CCA credits you need. Network on our trade show floor and join us in giving away scholarships and honorariums presented by Western Region CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
The California rice industry is supporting a program to help ag businesses suffering from drought. California Rice Commission CEO Tim Johnson said the $75 million drought grant program approved by the state legislature will help ag support businesses that directly serve farmers. This is not a farms program, rather it's a program open to ag suppliers, rice dryers, mills, agricultural aircraft companies, ag trucking firms, and small or socially disadvantaged farmers with 100 or fewer employees in 2019. Rice farmers have prevented planting insurance, according to Johnson. This is about how they help those in a supply chain who are affected by the lack of acreage in a drought. California rice growers planted about 250,000 acres of rice this year. This is about half of what the industry typically plants each year, according to Johnson. The effects of such a decline ripple far and wide through local economies across Northern California, he said. Grants will be available based on the loss of gross revenue or gross profits in 2022 when compared to 2019. Qualified businesses will receive grants of between $60,000 and $100,000 to offset their losses, and losses will be verified by tax returns. The California Governor's Office of Small Business is expected to provide information on the program this fall, with applications opening in early 2023. State agricultural officials reported recently that revenue to California farms and ranches rose 3.6% last year to reach $51.1 billion. Kern County's specific figures are not expected to be released until later in October, but the county's prospects may have lifted with the California Department of Food and Agriculture's report showing crops that sold well locally in 2020, which include dairy, grapes, and almonds, led the state last year in grower revenue. Imports were down, according to the report, which cited 2020 data showing California shipped $20.8 billion in ag commodities that year, down 4.1% from 2019. Citing the University of California Davis data, CDFA said the state's top ag exports were almonds, dairy, pistachio, walnuts, wine, and in that order. Kern County Ag Commissioner Glenn Fankhauser said he views the report as possibly reflective of price increases. It may also be, he added, that higher revenues will help to compensate for water scarcity that caused a lot of cutbacks in the amount of farmland used for crops. Executive Director Romeo Agbalog of the Kern County Farm Bureau was less optimistic, noting by email that CDFA's figures do not take into account rising costs that growers continue to wrestle with in the areas of labor, fuel, fertilizer, water, seeds, trees, and expenses related to increasing regulations. The CDFA report ranked dairy products and milk as California's most valuable ag commodities in 2021 with $7.57 billion in revenue to dairies. That's up 1.4% from the year before. Dairy ranked as Kern County's fifth highest grossing commodity in 2020 at almost $662 million in sales. Next on the department's list was grapes at $5.23 billion in 2021 receipts, or 17% more than a year before. Grapes were Kern County's top crop in 2020, accounting for $1.45 billion in revenue. Almonds ranked third in the state last year with sales of $5.03 billion, or 10% less than in 2020. They placed third in 2020 in Kern with $1.14 billion in gross sales. Strawberry sales, which did not make Kern's top 20 list in 2020, came in fifth statewide at $3.02 billion. That's an increase of 52%. 2% year over year. And pistachios, Kern's fourth-ranking crop in 2020 at more than $944 million in gross receipts, came in sixth statewide last year with revenue of $2.91 billion, up 1.2% from 2020. More than 97% of California is under at least severe drought conditions, raising the specter of difficult agricultural decisions in a state that produces a quarter of U.S. food. Farming is a main driver of water usage in the state, and a drought now in its third year comes alongside increasing pressure on California to bear more of the burden of Colorado River water cutbacks. As of last week, 97.52% of the nation's most populous state is in a state of severe drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, while 99.76% is at least moderate drought. This time last year, 95.56% of the state was classified as under severe drought. Much of the drought has been concentrated in the northern part of the state, according to the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center. That's an important problem since Southern California gets much of its water supplies from the Sacramento Valley. California produces more than one-third of U.S. vegetables and three-quarters of domestic fruits and nuts. During 2020 and 2021, the USDA's Farm Service Agency provided $31 billion in aid to more than 950,000 producers of agricultural commodities, including crops, dairy, and livestock. The goal was to help offset losses and costs associated with COVID-19. The Government Accountability Office found problems in the process the FSA used to review claims under CFAP submitted by producers. For example, the agency reviewed the claims of 90 producers and over half did not provide support for their payments. GAO says $661.5 million distributed went to high-income producers whose average annual adjusted gross income exceeded $900,000 over 3 years. The average payment per producer was highest in California at over $97,600. Iowa, California, and Nebraska each received over $2 billion in CFAP payments. 8 other states received at least $1 billion. 7 individual operations received at least $3 million in total payments.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
Taylor Chalstrom is in with his report on an ancient grafting technique bolstering the California watermelon industry.
As growers across California navigate severe drought, supply chain challenges, and rising inflation, reducing inputs has become an existential necessity. And for watermelon growers, a new twist on a thousands-year-old practice is showing real promise. In the summer of 2018, watermelon growers brought a pressing problem to Jiang Wang, who had recently joined UCCE as the Vegetable Crops and Irrigation Advisor for Stanislaus, San Joaquin, and Merced counties. Growers were seeing an increasing number of their cartons rejected by supermarkets and other buyers because of the melons' inconsistent quality, and Wang wondered if the ancient technique of grafting would help the state's melon growers, who plant about 10,000 acres of the crop each year. Although California is the number 3 watermelon-producing state in the U.S. behind Florida and Georgia, there has been relatively little research on the melon across the state.
Frankly, our watermelon growers, at least here in California, know the benefits of grafting to improve the fruit quality and reduce number of loads that were rejected due to the quality deficiency, such as we know hollow heart, which is one of the biggest physiological disorders for the watermelon fruit. But to your question, the root of the issue was that grafting was not widely adopted among the watermelon growers in California because the number one barrier, or maybe the most important limiting factor, is the production cost in general. Growers have a concern about using grafting will increase the production cost. Well, how we can make the better use of that to produce more fruit, to produce the fruit with a higher quality while reducing the cost and making a bigger revenue for the growers. So in other words, the goal we want to accomplish is to put a theory into an actionable practice. It's not only to stay on the textbook, but go to the reality, go to the field, let people use the grafting more confidently.
Fresh from his postdoctoral work at The Ohio State University on grafting fresh market tomatoes, Wang knew that vegetable growers understood the theoretical benefits of grafting, which combines a scion, the above-ground part of a plant, with the sturdy rootstock of a related plant.
There is a big potential for promoting this ancient production tool for watermelons. And knowing the issue of production cost, reducing the cost seems the imperative goal. And on the farmer's end, using less plants per acre by increasing the plant spacing seems applicable to increase or at least make comparable yields to the non-grafted plants by utilizing the strong root system and vigorous plant development. And as we know that there are a lot of many other ways of reducing the production cost by having, you know, reducing the cost of breeding of the different rootstocks or reduction of seed cost. But those are the, you know, the practices which is kind of a relatively more difficult for growers to pursue. So it seems like the only way now that is doable to growers is to reduce the plant population. But what made me consider is like, what to this kind of a reduction of population, to what extent, which is the optimal in terms of balancing the yield and the quality while not increasing the size, you know, crazily. So should we drop like 30%, 40%, 50%, or even more? So that's kind of make me consider using this technique to solve the issue.
After 2 years of trials, the growers determined with strong confidence that watermelons planted 4 to 5 feet apart could produce a yield equal to or surpassing that of plants 3 feet apart, the standard for their non-grafted counterparts. According to Wang, growers reported that on average, their successfully grafted fields produced 15 to 25% more watermelons than non-grafted fields per acre, while using 30% fewer plants and the same amount of water and fertilizers. With the potential for greater profitability, grafting could be a major help during a particularly challenging time for growers.
Most of the symptoms we noticed in the field was that grafted plants had a much longer life cycle in terms of vegetative period, fruiting period, and making the harvest window longer as well. So usually you can see the first yield of non-grafted plots could be higher than the grafted ones, but then the yield kept declining until field termination. But in the grafted fields, usually they had continued productivity, where usually the second or even the third pick was the biggest. And then when after several harvests, when you put more water and nitrogen, the vines and watermelon runners grow back, producing even more harvest. So somehow I say where even the grower reacts is watermelon is almost like a six-month crop. You can transplant in April, while and the end of the harvest probably early October. So it's never follow what the seed package says, like 85 days of that's only the dates for the from your transplant to the first harvest. And for the insights, we believe that grafted plants may have a different growth pattern just based on our observations and also in terms of like a demanding irrigation and a fertilization, as well as a unique strategy to tell when the optimal time of harvesting would be. So following the same plans for non-grafted production may not fully stimulate the biggest potential of grafted plants yield.
Zhang said using grafting has opened up a new channel in the watermelon world and for all vegetable production in California. Next up for Wang is testing various combinations of scions and rootstocks. This year, he began variety trials with rootstocks of various cucurbit family members like hybrid squashes, citron, and bottle gourd, with hopes of producing results that watermelon growers could use to decide the best options for their local conditions. You're listening to My Ag Life. I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
Broadband, soil health, and rail service are all topics before the House Agriculture Committee this week as the House returns from summer recess. Broadband and soil health practices are before the full ag panel, while rail service is in front of two House subcommittees, though broadband, part of the Farm Bill, is probably the highest profile of the three issues. Congress approved $65 billion for broadband nationally as part of the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, but FCC service mapping needed to target the funds hit some early roadblocks that are now cleared. Biden administration's infrastructure advisor Mitch Landrieu.
The expectation is before the end of the year sometime that they will have made substantial progress on the work that they're doing, and that the programs out of the Department of Commerce and the Department of Agriculture will be part of that.
Broadband is critical for rural homes, hospitals, schools, libraries, businesses, and farmers, but not just any broadband. USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. So
appreciate that, sir. No, it's just zero, zero. There's Walker got in mouth, but it's now for physical destruction. Mr. Off, that's the blood destruction. Me, I said, the you do sign up. And an idiot, see, I have a solo. And an investigation is a logo.
They just announced more than $1 billion in round four of its Reconnect program for providers to expand rural high-speed internet access, adding to the $1.8 billion invested so far. And on that topic of the Reconnect program, and also from USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, he has announced that USDA is accepting applications for its Reconnect program loans and grants to expand access to high-speed internet for millions of people in rural America. The agency is making over $1 billion available for the program, a critical piece of the effort to connect every American to affordable and reliable high-speed internet, according to a USDA press release. Ensuring that the people of rural America get connected with reliable high-speed internet brings new and innovative ideas to the rest of the country, according to Vilsack. He says that's why high-speed internet is an important part of USDA Rural Development's work with rural communities. USDA is accepting applications for loans with available funds of $150 million, grants with available funds of $700 million, and combination loan grant awards using $300 million under the Reconnect program. Reliable high-speed internet opens a world marketplace to rural business owners, according to Vilsack. The application deadline is November 2nd. For more information, log on to rd.usda.gov. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai and Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo hosted counterparts from the 13 Indo-Pacific Economic Framework partner countries. Those partners represent over 40% of the world's economy. At the first official in-person ministerial meeting, the ministers had positive and constructive discussions and announced a substantial milestone in their pursuit of the framework. This meeting was a chance to deepen partnerships and fill in the details about how they will work collectively to address the challenges and opportunities that will define the 21st century, according to Tai. As the meeting concluded, the partners reached a consensus on ministerial statements for each of the four IPEF pillars, including trade, supply chains, clean economies, and fair economies. After days of intensive discussions, they made real progress towards that goal, and Tai says she is excited to continue developing this framework, which will unlock enormous economic value for the region and be an example for the world. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack discusses some of the expectations and potential discussion from the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health, which is scheduled for September 28th.
The White House Conference on Hunger that's coming up the latter part of this month, this is going to be a very robust effort. Having looked at the proposed agenda and the people that are participating in the agenda, I can tell you that it's going to be a very busy day, a very packed day, a very long but a very substantive day. I think people are quite serious about coming out of this conference with a roadmap that will indicate that while we have done a lot of work, there is still work to be done. Part of what will come out of this conference is a strategic plan, if you will, that is in the process of being formulated. There will also be additional recommendations coming from folks who are presenting on a variety of aspects. When you get into the issue of hunger and nutrition, you get into an area that is pretty complex, a lot more complex than people realize. And there are a lot of voices and a lot of interest. And it is also encouraging organizations and groups to also think internally about, well, okay, what would we do? What should we advocate? What should we advance?
USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, and I'm Lori Boyer for the My Ag Life Daily News Report.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research,
advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
And now here's Kylie Harlan with information on Ag Groups' pleas to federal officials for quick availability on water project funding.
Farmers in the western part of the United States are facing not only severe drought, but also water shortages. At the end of August, a coalition of agricultural organizations sent a letter to the Department of Interior Secretary and the Bureau of Reclamation Commissioner urging them to quickly implement funding for drought assistance. Dan Keppen, the Executive Director for Family Farm Alliance, one of the organizations on the letter, tells us more about the letter's contents.
Well, so right now, as you know, throughout the West, farmers and ranchers are facing, you know, serious, dire challenges in the Colorado River Basin, Central Valley, California, the Klamath Basin, where I live, Columbia River, Rogue River, here in Southern Oregon, the Great Basin, Nevada, Utah. And we represent a lot of irrigation districts and farmers and ranchers throughout the West, and most of them right now are really having to react to some major water shortages. So in the Colorado River Basin, which is sort of the been a focus of a lot of our energies here this summer, the Bureau of Reclamation just a few weeks ago declared the first ever Tier 2A shortage. They're calling for a total of 2 to 4 million acre feet of water to protect critical levels in both Lake Mead, which is behind Hoover Dam, and Lake Powell, which is behind Glen Canyon Dam. In recent months, a lot of our producers and water managers that with senior water rights have been engaged in efforts to sort of try to come up with, you know, emergency plans to help protect the Colorado River system from crashing. So in late July and early August, we worked with Western senators, mostly from the Colorado River, you know, caucus, California, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, to help secure $4 billion to respond to the ongoing Western drought. That was included in the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA for short, that was signed by President Biden last month. A few weeks ago, a group of Western ag organizations, including the Family Farm Alliance, Western Growers, the California Farm Bureau, and three other state farm bureaus, the Arizona Ag Business and Water Council, sent a letter to the Secretary of Interior and Commissioner Tootin at the Bureau of Reclamation, urging them to quickly move to implement these IRA dollars and any other, you know, available drought money, get it on the ground ASAP. So a lot of time and effort right now are being put into the development of sort of these emergency response plans by our Colorado River water users. And that's sort of who we had in mind as we were heading into these negotiations. Right now, the ability for these ag producers to actually participate in programs that, you know, voluntarily compensate them to reduce their water use becomes difficult, if not impossible, if they don't start this stuff soon. And that's because the time frames associated with contracting and purchasing and planning of crops for the upcoming year. It's really important in areas like the Imperial Valley or Yuma, Arizona, where you have large scale wintertime ag production occurring. The process and the timing of the federal government to deliver drought response funding has to recognize that and be responsive, you know, to the reality of that. So our letter basically encourages Interior and Reclamation to work with our organizations and our members to first release a notice of funding availability. This would provide guidance to water managers currently developing drought response proposals and quickly deliver that funding to address the most urgent needs. Our ag coalition also continues to sort of monitor the progress of the billions of dollars provided in the bipartisan infrastructure law, which was signed by President Biden last November. There's $8.3 billion in there for the Bureau of Reclamation to do infrastructure projects, which can provide sort of long-term solutions to the drought challenges in California and other parts of the West. USDA also received billions of dollars in the bipartisan infrastructure law to help tackle forest health and develop rural infrastructure projects. So our coalition that I just talked about, along with 100 other sort of water, urban, and ag organizations, played a really instrumental role in working with Congress to secure those funds last year. Now we just need to make sure that those dollars end up serving their intended purpose on the ground, conserving and creating new water supplies.
While the letter addressed many of the organization's short-term water funding goals, Keppen provides us insight on what they would like to see in the long run.
We want to make sure that this bipartisan infrastructure law is actually implemented by the agency efficiently and effectively and ends up with, you know, projects on the ground. that law can actually help us finance and construct infrastructure that helps us address drought in the long term. It's got funding in there for forest restoration activities that can actually improve the health and the productivity of the watersheds. Our infrastructure coalition last year, we treated forests and watersheds as infrastructure, right? It's sort of part of the whole water balance. If you have unhealthy forests, you're not going to have water yields that you know we've been relying on for in the past. So, you know, especially in the upper Colorado River Basin and parts of California too, you've got federal lands that are just dying because of mismanagement. They're way out of balance, and tackling those forest needs is one way to address long-term water needs in the, say, the Colorado River Basin. Healthy forests yield more water. So that's a really important part of our long-term solution. We want to see, you know, conservation actions, you know, continue to expand. We have farmers ranchers doing lots of good things throughout the West already in that department. I think there's going to be a lot of water recycling programs built with the bipartisan infrastructure law and continued sort of water use efficiency work. We're also pushing for water supply enhancement actions, and the bipartisan infrastructure law provides authority and dollars to do, you know, new storage projects, groundwater development, new conveyance facilities. All those things are where appropriate, can be really, really helpful. And really, you know, when you look at this new block of funds we got from the IRA for drought response, if it's deployed soon, it should like perfectly complement sort of the longer term investments made by that bipartisan infrastructure law from last year. So together, I mean, these two opportunities are sort of a once in a generation investment by the government. And it presents a sort of an integrated approach that I think should boost both short, medium, and long term drought response, make us better prepared, make us more resilient. And ultimately, I think that's going to help farms, ranches, and communities across the West.
The Family Farm Alliance, as well as the other agricultural groups involved in this letter, would ultimately like to see the government working more closely with ag organizations and water users.
Our letter asks the Interior Department and the Bureau of Reclamation to consider several approaches as they develop a plan to deploy this $4 billion of drought funding. First, you know, Reclamation has to work with the local water managers to explain the considerations and approaches that they're going to use in spending these dollars. That way, I think we'll have a better chance of achieving desired and defensible outcomes that works for Reclamation and also works for, you know, stakeholders in the Colorado River Basin in particular. In places like the Colorado River Basin where voluntary water right reductions might occur, which it's spelled out in the law, those programs have to set goals that really focus on driving the participation that's going to be needed by farmers and ranchers to produce measurable volumes of wet water. And we've also told Reclamation that local water managers should be the ones that sort of determine what are those actions, you know, what, how are we going to get water backed up in behind Hoover Dam through farmers using less water downstream? It could be conservation. It could be deficit irrigation. It could be temporary fallowing. All of those things that could be used to achieve those targets should be ultimately decided by the producers working with the local districts and not sort of mandated from on high by the federal government. We also believe that Reclamation needs to kind of keep the process and the selection criteria and any sort of agreements that are developed simple and transparent. You know, we got to move this thing along. If those program requirements are too prescriptive or too complicated or overly restrictive, we're going to see, you know, progress delayed, and we're going to lose participation by farmers in those programs if that happens. And that's going to defeat the purpose of what they're trying to do. The IRA drought provisions specifically identifies actions that would temporarily reduce ag water use, especially in the lower basin. That's sort of a tricky one. I mean, basically, our farmers are saying, look, we're willing to participate on a short-term compensated voluntary basis, but we're hoping that we'll buy time, keep water in the system to prevent the Colorado River from crashing so we have time to develop meaningful long-term solutions. So that program really has to recognize in the short term the value of the lost farm production, what that does to the communities that depend on agriculture, like in the Imperial Valley and around Yuma, and the cost of developing incremental new water supplies, you know, to offset those short-term impacts. We absolutely have to avoid actions that result in sort of profound long-term economic impacts to these rural communities. And then also we need to make sure that, you know, we protect our long-term capacity to produce food and fiber. There's a lot of folks in other parts of the world that rely on that, you know? So ultimately, I guess any water solution that's developed here, working with Interior and Reclamation, we got to make sure that the water solution doesn't lead to a food supply problem for our country.
This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.